Good morning, and we're ready to start lesson number 23 in our series, Rudiments Unto Perfection, the Whole Counsel of God. Lesson 23 is an extension of last week's lesson, and it's entitled, Of Wrath and Mercy. Of Wrath and Mercy. Now, the section of scripture which we're going to be working on today is the entire first chapter of Habakkuk and one verse of the second chapter of Habakkuk. And it turns out that wrath and mercy are the two of the four subjects that are entertained and discussed in this section of Scripture. The first thing to be discussed is the occasion of wrath, which is the sin that goes before, and the wrath that is therefore enjoined and brought to bear as a consequence, the penalty, if you will. The mercy then comes into play in terms of the prophet's discussion with God, and then we're going to finally look at the nature of deliverance, how that mercy is delivered to the saints, what they can and cannot count on from God. Starting from the very first, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save? We see now that Habakkuk is a busy prophet calling unto God to correct and punish the nation for what it's doing. So here is a prophet crying out for wrath from God against an unrighteous people. Now, what is offended in the prophet's soul? It's not self-interest at all. He is offended because God's law is being destroyed and broken, you see. Therefore, he is making cause with God and God's law. Remember what David said, rivers of waters roll down my cheeks or my eyes because they're breaking and, trampling underfoot your law. That's where Habakkuk starts. He is reacting on behalf of God's law being broken. So it is a righteous anger that he feels, and he's calling for the just reward for what's going on around him, the violence and the evil that's going on around him. So here, you have to be very careful to understand he is pleading God's case and seeing it through God's eyes, and he is wounded and offended because of God's law being treated so shabbily and God's people being the victims of all these violent, evil men who seem to have gained the upper hand in this society. So he's urging God's law at this point, not self-interest, God's law. Why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? And that's the next interesting step. God is making sure that Habakkuk is in all the places where he can actually see these travesties and these transgressions going on. He doesn't just show it to him, he causes him to behold it, which is the next step. It's like forcing someone to look at it and causing him to behold. See, so there's no way that Habakkuk can get away from the sight. God puts him in a place where he can see exactly what's going on with Israel. He's got the bird's eye view of a nation going down the tube. And it hurts him and grieves him. And why are you showing me iniquity and forcing me to behold grievance? So we get iniquity, grievance, things that grieve, things that cause pain, suffering for people. For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. So all down the line, all the possible things that arise from, of course, pride is the root cause, because from pride cometh contention, as Proverbs and Paul points out. Warrings and strife and contention, all these are put right before Habakkuk's eye. So that this is how long, again, and that's the reason he's crying out. Because he's forced to behold and to see, and God shows him all this evil going on around him. And so he's calling out, because he feels the injury to God's law, how long will I cry out before you punish rightfully all the stuff that's going on? How long are you forcing me to keep watching this? And forcing me to watch what's going on? Therefore, the law is slack. The law is slacked. Now, the general picture, of course, is that the law should be a tight rope, if you will, a tight cord. It's always maintained tight, and we observe it. But when you slack it, it's loose and can shift around and move and isn't nearly as effective as a boundary against sin, because it's the transgression line. It shows you what to do, how to go, and how not to go. And when you slack that, then the cords, as you were, are loose, and people can do pretty much what they want. So we see here that there's a weakening of the influence of God's law. Weakening of the influence of God's law. One can say many other words. I've seen it rendered, some Latin scholars say, well, mali means to dissolve it, or to weaken it, or to do this or that to the law. But to slacken it is a good idea, or to weaken it, or to minimize, or trivialize, or to overlook, or treat a part of it, or simply neglect important details. All of these are slacking of the law. It's slackened. Okay? Let's get a real good, strong picture of what's going on. What it should be, God has delivered as a nice, tight line against sin, is slacked. And the people who were supposed to hold the line have slackened the line against sin. Okay? So things that previously were regarded as totally forbidden, we now entertain and exercise and do. Okay? We're now in a position where we do things and the law is slacked. Or slackened. Same idea. And judgment doth never go forth. Well, that's a consequence. If the law is slacked, how can judgment, which requires that we hold a line on God's law, go forth? Because a slacking of God's law, that is the setting aside of details of it to weaken it or to lessen it, you know, whoever breaks the least of the commandments and teaches men so shall be least in the kingdom of heaven. This is the kind of thing that we're talking about, is a slacking of God's law. It gives specific details about things, and when we weaken or slacken it, boom, what happens? Judgment cannot go forth. Judgment is by definition perverted because the law has been slacked. I don't know how it happens, or what is urged to defend the slacking of God's law. All sorts of excuses throughout Christian history for 2,000 centuries have excused the slacking of God's law. Well, we're interested in the big commandments, not the minor details. So we slacken God's law. But the point you do that, even when you say, we need to talk about the big, major things, you know, justice and mercy and the two great commandments. But if those are the pretext for slacking God's law, Habakkuk is telling us, therefore, judgment cannot go forward. It's impossible. You slack the law of God, judgment is out of the question, because that law of God, where it was slacked, was addressing how judgment should be administered. So we must destroy our concept of judgment and justice with God if we have any intention to ever defend the slacking of God's commandments on any point, because they speak God's truth. They are not optional little areas of triviality that we can say, well, that's just a detail, it's not as important as the big picture. Everything is important with God's law. You know, the number of a pronoun is what allowed Paul to gain a victory in terms of who Christ was. He said, not seeds as of many, but seed as of one, which is Christ. So the entire argument there rolled around the one word, and whether it's a singular or a plural word for seed. So you cannot take the word of God and say, no, this is just a minor commandment, it's not so important, or this evidentiary law is not critical, or this requirement for restitution or reproof or rebuke can be done away with or absolved or dissolved or slackened. The second you do that, by definition, justice and judgment cannot go forward. And it is a pretext to problems, or rather a precursor, if you will, to problems. It's a pretext that causes problems, but it is also the source of a whole institution going awry, whether that be a nation or a family or a church, any institution that starts to slacken God's law, judgment is now standing afar off. Remember that horrid section of Isaiah 59 where he picks justice, you know, truth staggers in the street, and his justice is far off there. That's the kind of severe decline, if you will, of a society that happens when the law is slackened. Got so slackened so badly, and Hosea finally says, you know, I spoke to Ephraim of the great things of my law, wonderful things of my law, but he esteemed them a strange thing. See? So when you slacken the God's law and don't hold the line on it and at all its details, boom, suddenly becomes like a strange thing. What's that ordinance? What kind of statute did God write there? He doesn't expect us to keep that. It's obviously for some Israeli 1,600 years, you know, or 2,000 years ago, Moses' time. Don't bother with that. Don't worry about that. We're into the big picture. We walk by grace. But that becomes a problem because judgment and justice are always brought to the plumb line of God's law. And no other place are they brought to be determined. There is no other standard except the law of God written for what is just and what is judgmentally correct, what is true, what must be done in a situation. Therefore, when we slacken that plumb line, or slacken the line, judgment cannot go forward. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceedeth. We have a situation here. Now, compass can be one of two areas. You can compass someone in numbers, meaning, you know, the wicked are all around me, meaning they form a circle around me and I'm in the middle and they're out there and on all sides. But this can also happen in another way. Compassing about can be institutionally, which is to say, all the rulers in the various spheres are wicked. Those from whom judgment is supposed to proceed are wicked, you see. All you need for this nation to be compassed about with wickedness is for 435 representatives, 100 senators, and 9 Supreme Court justices, and a president to all be wicked. In essence, with only something less than 600 people, the entire nation is compassed about with unrighteous people, because they're the ones who hold the reins of power. Therefore, at the institutional level, the nation is then compassed, the righteous are then compassed with the wicked. Because at that point, not just their sheer numbers, but rather the seats of authority they hold is what makes it possible for the final phrase to happen. Therefore, wrong judgment proceedeth. Wrong judgment proceedeth. So several steps there. One, law slackened. Two, as a consequence, judgment never doth go forward, for the wicked doth compass about the righteous. That is, they hold either physical superior numbers and are arrayed on all sides, or they hold institutional authority and therefore compass us about. So finally render four, that wrong judgment proceedeth. Wrong judgment proceedeth. Okay. That is, the decisions made by bodies that have already slackened God's law are almost guaranteed to be faulty. The first clause says as much. It says, can never go forward. True judgment can never go forward if the law is slackened. That's how attentive we must be to the details. You know, people say, oh, he's a detailed man. All he's talking about is those 600-odd commandments in the Old Testament. But the point is, will justice be misadministered, or shall injustice prevail from a man who does that? Highly unlikely. Guaranteed, the man who slackens God's law, we learn already by definition, is not just, because what is just is determined by the law of God, not by men's feelings about it. Certainly not by what's convenient for men, because this is what's going on here. The wicked compass about the righteous, and therefore wrong judgment proceedeth. It doesn't say there's no judgment proceeding. It says wrong judgment proceeds. Okay, so this is the cause of the wrath that's about to come on the nation. So this is the case that is argued by Habakkuk. He's calling for judgment against the nation because of all these things. Law being slackened, wrong judgment proceeding, etc., etc. Verse 5. Behold ye among the heathen in regard, and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. So we're going to, again, point out that this is an area of disbelief. God will work the work, it'll be even told them to their face, and they won't believe it. The thing they won't believe is that they're being acted upon by a righteous God. That God is going to raise up a bunch of heathen Chaldeans and use them against Israel. Because they won't believe that God's the one who's to be credited with Israel being given over into Babylonian hands. And yet it'll be told them plainly that God's the actor. Because they will not acknowledge that, they'll do all the judgment on Israel that God commands, and then God's going to go rip Babylon to shreds afterward. Because they will not acknowledge, so he told them to their face that he was the one giving Israel over into Chaldean hands. For lo, verse 6, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than the leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from afar. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. And they shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. This entire passage is God's answer to Habakkuk. And he's making it very plain what he's about to do. Habakkuk is recording it. He's going to raise up the Chaldeans. And this is the point of conflict when we continue on. This was not the expected resolution that Habakkuk was looking for. He wanted God's law saved. But here, he picks a bunch of bums. A bunch of wicked people. It doesn't make sense. You know, as far as Habakkuk is concerned, Israel's a righteous nation and backslid. So you know, it must be, you don't need to correct this, Lord, but you're going to correct it internally, right? It's an internal matter. You don't need to. Least of all, you're going to correct Jew with Jew and send forth a new spirit of healing and stuff like that. Well, God does the exact opposite of what's expected. He raises up the Babylonian pagans, these heathens who don't honor God. In fact, it even says in the final verse we looked at that they will offend, imputing all this to their false gods. That they're going to go through like a gigantic war machine and take territory with impunity and with terror and fierceness and violence, and they will attribute it all to them, their own gods doing it. Though God says at the beginning, I'm going to tell you a wonderful thing, all these things I'm going to bring into your hand, but you will not believe it, even though it be told unto you, that God of Israel is allowing this to happen and is the mover in this gigantic Chaldean war machine that swallows up territory and peoples with impunity. They impute this power unto his God. So what's going to happen is that Israel is going to get beat to a pulp, and the Chaldeans are going to do it, and the Chaldeans are going to glorify whatever their Chaldean gods are. I don't know the name. I mean, they're probably Marduks and a bunch of Baalim and Molechs and who knows what. Chemoshes. There's a whole bunch of panoply of gods, pantheon of gods for these crazy Babylonians. I guess you can call them Iraqis today, I guess. But the point is that, what? Jehovah's not going to get credit for it. Israel's going to be stomped, and the Babylonian gods are going to be glorified and given all the credit for stomping and destroying Jehovah's people and taking them captive. And this is what God predicts is going to happen. And this part now outrages the prophet Habakkuk. And now he's motivated for sympathy for his people, because, of course, he does not delight in the downfall of even his own wicked people, least of all at the hands of a Chaldean. And worst of all, that God's name would be trampled in the dust in the process. Remember how Moses argued with God about, you know, God said, I'll just destroy all this people right now in the desert since you don't want to listen to me. And he said, well, what will all the pagans and nations around about say that you couldn't bring them all the way to Canaan? You delivered them from Egypt, but you couldn't get them all the way there, and they'll laugh at the name of Jehovah. And so this is the appeal that Habakkuk's going to start, saying, hey, this impinges on the name of Jehovah, and why are you doing this with the Chaldean people of all things? So, here comes Habakkuk. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine holy one? See that? Mine holy one? Remember what Abraham said? He said, will not the judge of the whole earth do right, when God announced he was going to go in there and wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah? And Abraham pleaded God's righteousness to him. He says, will not the judge of the whole earth do right? If there are 100 or 50 honest men there, will you destroy the city? Would that be right to do? So here now Habakkuk is pleading God's holiness. So aren't you a holy God? Why would a holy God send Chaldeans against Jews? Look what kind of people the Chaldeans are. Then you're going to let them glory in it over themselves and praise their own gods for this? And make Jehovah, you make yourself look bad in the process? We shall not die. So he's confident, of course, that the chosen people will not die. They won't be perished. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment. He acknowledges that they are ordained for judgment. And, O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Is this what the Chaldeans are all about? He acknowledges, of course, that they are coming not to destroy, but for judgment and correction. He acknowledges that. He said, I know that we're not going to die, because that's not God's purpose for Israel. You are bringing this big horde to judge and correct us. But, verse 13, thou art a purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he? In other words, how could you stand by and watch as these Chaldeans devour and take away the Jews and take them captive? Because a Jew, an Israeli, is a far more righteous person than the Chaldean. The Chaldean worships false gods and sacrifices their kids in the fire and who knows what else. We at least worship Jehovah, though imperfectly, and we backslide a bit. But by and large, we're far more just than they are. So why would you use this evil, wicked nation and look the other way when they eat and devour us? See? So this is now an appeal to God's mercy that is coming forth from Habakkuk. And this is always a big, big, big surprise to people of God, that God would use a bunch of heathens and God-haters to correct his people. Now, the good news is It's for correction and judgment, but not destruction. We will not die. And you know, that's a very important point. We recall how Job said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. We need to be in that point. And we have to have faith that God will deliver. If not in this life, then certainly second death hath no power over us anyway. We should be fearless. But he knows it's for correction, but he's saying, I cannot believe that God was going to let the Chaldeans, such a wicked people, go after far more righteous people. But you know, this points out the entire point. This is what America says, well, we're pretty good people. What do we do? I haven't murdered anyone, here's a claim, and I haven't stolen anybody's property. And we get surprised if we would ever get overrun by a nation of, you know, real wicked people. Can't imagine when, maybe if Cuba invaded us and successfully took us over, you'd say, how could that happen? How come such a godless, atheist man in a wicked regime like Cuba take over America? How can God let that happen? Well, we're learning here that as far back as Habakkuk's time and Isaiah's, when these same incursions were predicted, that's God's way. We deserve it. And God chooses an unrighteous nation to chastise the righteous one as fallen. See? You know, that's the danger of being lukewarm, of being hot for the Lord and then cooling off. Get in big, big judgmental trouble. So we can say that all trouble seems to come from God. Who's the author of this big catastrophe against Israel? Not the Chaldeans, but God. Right? We read in Amos 3:6, it says, shall evil come upon a city, and the Lord hath not done it? Couldn't it come upon a city except the Lord hath done it? Look, God is the source of the evils that come upon a city, because they are a form of judgment from God. Sin, slacking of God's law, leads to the evil of that takes place in the city. And God sends it judicially. It's a punishment phase. Not that God is winking at it, or God lets it happen. God brings it to pass. God raises up the Chaldeans, and he gives these things into the people's hands, as we'll see in the next couple of verses. Okay? So what we see is you're going to see a bunch of treachery and devouring, wicked men devouring more righteous men. It doesn't say a absolutely righteous man, it just says a man more righteous than that wicked person. So all that tells us is that being more righteous than a wicked person don't matter much. Remember the person said, well, you know, are you going to go to heaven or hell? He said, well, I'm more righteous than this person. I didn't do the things that Jeffrey Dahmer did or something like that. But that doesn't mean too much, because we can see that a person who's more righteous than these wicked Chaldeans is still going to get devoured by the Chaldean, and rightfully so. So urging mere superiority more in moral sense to another human being is totally irrelevant. And God, you know, is disgusted with that whole notion. You're supposed to be responsible to God for your standards, not determine a standard based on the lowest common human denominator. Where does that standard come from, and where does that have standing in God's eyes? It doesn't. Precisely because God is of holy eyes and is holy one, this argument doesn't make any sense. Verse 14 is interesting. It's the one that I was leading up to. He's talking about God. You, God, makest men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. They take up all of them with the angle. They catch them in their net and gather them in their drag, and therefore they rejoice and are glad. It's talking about the Chaldeans, which are represented as fishermen. The Jews are set forth as the fish, ready to be snagged and caught. And they can be snagged and caught one of several ways. One, by the fishing pole, the angle, talking about angling and the angler. Secondly, the net, which gets even bigger draughts of fish. And finally, the drag net, which gets the whole, you know, lagoon full of fish at one shot. And it says the Chaldeans, the fishermen as you were, rejoice and are glad, because of course all the fish in the sea are prime targets for fishermen. And the Chaldeans don't see the Jews in any better light than a fisherman sees his fish, just something to catch and rejoice to say, boy, we got all this. Don't see them as human beings. See them as property, nothing more than business property to be sold and enjoyed. So don't even treat them as human beings. But who made the Jews to be like fish of the sea? Yes, the fact that they've now become prey and a target and a treasure to be plundered by the nets of the Chaldeans, God made that happen. God turned the nation of Israel into a bunch of worthless fish of the sea, valuable only to be caught and grabbed and taken under wing and taken captive by the Chaldeans. So when you see a nation that gets plundered, only one individual in all this universe and beyond can make a nation a prey for another nation and turn them into as fishes of the sea or as creeping things on the earth that have no governor over them. God makes you like that. God makes a nation a target, a legitimate target for attack, for conquest in this specific case. Because what we're talking about is a conquest where the Chaldeans just come in, throw their nets, throw their angles, and grab up all the Jews they can with impunity. So because of what happened earlier, slacking of the law, now I get to the point where God takes a nation of men and makes them as nothing as if but fishes in the sea. There to be caught. Ripe for the picking, as we would say, if we're talking about fruit. Ripe for the catching. A whole nest of them ready to go and to be delivered into Chaldean hands. And we see how inhuman the Chaldean attitude is toward the Israelis. They're not. The Chaldeans have the same attitude toward these Israelis that they're capturing and turning into slaves as fishermen have for the fish. It's just a fish. To them, it's just a Jew. So there's, you know, that's the way it's seen. It's the way the Chaldeans see it. And of course, this is provoking a call for mercy out of Habakkuk for the people. But he's also acknowledging who's doing it, who's pulling this off. See? Verse 16, therefore they sacrifice unto their net and burn incense unto their drag, because by them their portion is fat and their meat plenteous. See, what happens is that these Chaldeans therefore give honor to the tools by which they took conquest. They sacrifice and give honor unto the net, the drag, which is to say their horses, their chariots, all the military strength that was amassed for the purpose of taking Israel and everything in its path over, conquering it, and taking it captive.
Kind of reminds you of the parades that they used to hold in Moscow, bringing all the military.
Yes, right. Exactly, since where they had these May Day parades, that's where they're doing sacrifice and honoring their nets and their drags and their fishing poles for capturing all these, you call them, I can't remember the name of it now, Warsaw Pact nations. I guess are not so carefully attached to Russia anymore as of this taping. So we see that the credit for this event, so far as the Chaldeans is concerned, is what great nets we have, what great drags we have, what great fishing poles we've got, which is to say what great army we got. Horses and horsemen, fly as the eagle, terrible, swift, like the east wind, coming through, taking everything captive with nary a thought for what a Jew thinks about it, or feels about it, or the fact that the Jews are more righteous than other God's people. You know, they just treat them like fish, or mere creeping things. And they're all taken up. But it's intriguing again, verse 14 gives the main divine viewpoint. God made Israel into fishes of the sea for the taking. They would not have been in that boat except that they had slacked God's law, and that wrong judgment proceedeth from those that compassed about the righteous. So it doesn't take long to go from good to bad in a nation, even with prophets like this, trying to warn them of what's coming. And Habakkuk certainly is appealing to God's sense of mercy. Verse 17, the final appeal. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? Is empty the net to go fill it again and again and again. How long are they going to continue to continually slay the nations like this? How long are you going to let the Chaldeans pull this stunt off? See? The main thing that bothers him is that they are giving glory to themselves and their own means for accomplishing this judgment of God. Because they don't believe it's God allowing them to go in. And when they say, what God in their right mind would let a nation come in and successfully conquer their nation? What kind of God is that? So in the Babylonian viewpoint, they did it. Who's Jehovah? If Jehovah were anything, he would have protected his nation. We went in there and took it. So they have no doubt that there was no such thing. If there is a Jehovah, he's a weak, stupid God who let his people get captured and taken over by our great military machine. So we are right to worship and sacrifice our nets and our drags, which allowed us to conquer Israel here. Because only a stupid God would let his people get destroyed and taken slaves by another people. But turns out it's the only true God is the one who allowed that to happen. And in fact, he made them into fishes of the sea to be conquered. See? But fortunately, it's fishes of the sea that he's made them into, not to be destroyed, but simply to be caught, captured. Let's look at Job 31:27 real quickly. Let me put my ribbon in where we started. Job, of course, urges many things in his defense, things that he says he did not do and therefore could not be judged by God for doing, though some of these things were urged by his three friends against him, but he claimed he was innocent of them. Verse 27 of chapter 31, he's talking about all the things that he should be destroyed if he did that. And he claims he did not do this. Verse 27, "And my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth hath kissed my hand." Now it's that last phrase that's interesting. Both of them are important. My heart hath been in secretly enticed. That is, his heart has been lifted up, if you will. Lifted up in him. Pride now is a secret enticement in the heart. And then, "my mouth hath kissed my hand." What do you suppose that's talking about? My mouth has kissed my hand. Why would it be so bad to kiss your hand? Right, because your hand is the thing that you do things with. And to kiss your hand with your mouth is to say, "thank you, you did it all. My hands have done this." It's to give full credit for what your activities and your deeds to yourself. It's to kiss yourself. It's to, and here, the hand, the element or the part of the man that do with deeds. Because we have the mind and the hand, the forehead and the hand. So we see that he said, "I've never kissed my hand. I've never given anyone but God credit for everything that I've done." It is a sin against God to, in essence, kiss your hand and say, "I did this. I gathered. I provided the food for my family. I'm the one who made the money. Thank you, hand. Thank you for doing this. It was me." This self-orientation, Job categorically denies it's in him. He said, "I didn't do any of these things to the poor. I didn't do this. I didn't do this. And certainly, I did not kiss my hand." Well, it turns out that this is precisely the sin that the Chaldeans are guilty of. Not that the Jews are innocent of it, but I'm saying this is the very thing that Habakkuk is urging, that they are those that kiss their hand with their mouth. And he defines it in great detail, because they're sacrificing to their nets and honoring their drags, and making a big hup to do, and thanking anybody but God for what's going on. Good news, of course, is that as the Assyrian in Isaiah 10 is merely the axe that God wields and cannot do anything except that's God wielding the axe, so too the Chaldeans are in the same boat. They are not wielding themselves, though they think they are, and though they're giving thanks to themselves, and though they're kissing their own hands in the process, they are God's instruments, and they're totally in God's grip at every point. And that is why Habakkuk can take faithfully note, "We will not die. You have ordained them for judgment and established them for correction." See? Because he knows that it was God who made us the fish, and God's in control of these fishermen and these nets, because they're honoring and sacrificing to their means and their armies. But in fact, the entire time, though they don't know it, God's totally in control. And because God is completely in control of the entire event, no matter what it looks like, even these riot scenes and horrendous abominations and tortures and atrocities going on beyond belief to women and children, God is in control of that. "Shall evil come upon a city and the Lord have not sent it? Not done it," as Amos protests? No, absolutely not. One of the points that he's trying to make here is the same that Jeremiah makes as a prophet. He says, "Lord, correct us, but in your judgment, not in your wrath, lest we all die." So we know we're going to get harsh judgment from God. But it's going to be correctional. Sent them for judgment and correction. Not destruction. He didn't say to destroy Israel and wipe them out. He said, "Judge and correct. Put them back on the path." But these people fall in quite a ways, all starting with the slacking of God's law. Big fall there. People think it's a small fall because you say, "Well, we only overlooked a couple of little commandments, about little details, about a minor thing that involved only a couple $100 or something like that, or a couple of secretaries," whatever the occasion may be. Point is, you've relaxed the commandment. You've slackened it. And this is when wrong judgment starts to proceed. It proceeds and grows. It proceedeth. That is, it is now a continuous thing from that starting point of the law being slacked. Now that's slacked, it's easier to slacken the rest of the law. Because if you can set aside some, why not set aside more? Tell us a convenient smorgasbord. And from there we get all the way to this point of Chaldean fishermen capturing the entire nation and taking it away. And by the way, the scene did get pretty bad because I believe they blinded Zedekiah, killed his sons in front of him, and then they blinded him. Wanted to time that right. You know, the Chaldeans have a cruel sense of humor, as it were. Very vicious, very vicious people. So it's astonishing that this vicious people would be God's chosen tool, and yet totally in God's hand the entire time. So these are the things that keep the prophet in line, his acknowledgement and his knowledge of the fact that God is sending these people. They are ordained for judgment. They are established for correction. And yet it's astonishing that Israel would be corrected with a bunch of vicious heathen pagans that hate God and are going to worship false gods and give the false gods credit for what happens to Israel. Now, God is not one who long allows someone else to take his honor and glory. We know that chapter 2 begins and explains that, in fact, the Chaldeans are going to get theirs too. And as we all know, many, many tekel uparsin, found in the balance and wanting, did happen to the Babylonians, as Daniel records. And so they lost empire too, eventually, by very, very wise Persians. So, the important thing here is to see, how should we live in this situation? What do we do if we're in the boat that Habakkuk is? We're forced to look at all these things going on around us, and we know God may well send some other horde. We don't know what form it takes. Could be internal, could be external, could be queer nation for all I know. Who knows? I watch these things on the TV and you say, this is our country? This looks like an invasion in its own right, just to glance at what they're doing. They certainly see themselves as totally opposed to everything straight. Just as an example I could throw out among many that I know are dead set on their own agenda and dead set against God for certain. So it would be totally appropriate, given the decline of American Christianity, to use something like queer nation to judge and correct Christians. That shocks Christians to hear that. Use them? You know what they are? You know what they do? I know. And what makes them any less fit than Chaldeans, who judged Israel for slacking God's law? Shouldn't it not surprise us that they would be marching in the streets like that? Destroying things and ready to compass us about with their demands for pass this law to make us have these rights, blah, blah, blah. We know the entire agenda. Of course, they think we're homophobes, and so we've already been maligned, and by definition, our opinion doesn't count anymore. I'm saying that when you have these situations occur, whether they're internal or external, there's a very good chance that we're a group under judgment, an institution that has earned the right to become fish before the nets of the evil ones, and deserve it. But the good news is, their even queer nation is in God's hands, if they are just such a scourge against American Christianity. And if they be, the good news is they're ordained for our correction. They're there to wake us up. They're there to make us turn back to righteousness. Because it means that we were sitting on our laurels and thought we were so righteous, how could we ever come under this kind of attack and challenge? Well, because you weren't righteous, you slacked the law of God. So there shouldn't be any surprises here. The pattern from Habakkuk tells us God uses evil people to correct his people. God will use people that you would never think in a million years God would want anything to do but judge and destroy righteously. And he uses them and puts them, their foot, on the people, on the neck of God's people, because God's people deserved it and needed to be corrected hard. Now, good news, like Jeremiah says, correct us with judgment, but not in your wrath. So it's a focus and an element of God's judgment on us, but it's a judgment unto correction for us. That's the good news. Doesn't mean it's not going to be grievous. Certainly was grievous for Israel, because they were knocked out of their homeland for 70 years for slacking God's law. What should American Christians expect, considering what we do and tolerate? Shocker, huh? Well, the context that we're driving to is, what then shall we do? And there's only one answer in all of Habakkuk, and it's in 2:4. And it's the proper context for this verse, which has sometimes been twisted a little bit, not too badly, but enough to concern me. It says here, "Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him." The man whose soul is lifted up. Because anything we lift up is going to fall back down. Only God who lifts up, stays up, maintains someone lifted up. Remember, God's a lifter of my head. He lifts up his saints. When we lift ourselves up, that is, when in our own pride we elevate ourselves and magnify and kiss the hand, as Job 31:27 tells us, we do this, our heart is not upright in us. And this is the Chaldean boat, boats that all the Chaldeans are in. Their heart is lifted up in them because of this great conquest they're going to enjoy over Israel. Of course, it's short-lived because eventually the Medo-Persian dynasty takes over, right? So, but notice the second half. But the just shall live by his faith. That is, the just shall live by their faith. This is the solution. This is the path of the righteous who are compassed about by the wickedness. When this nation comes under judgment, or when Christianity comes under judgment, when the American church comes under judgment, then God makes it very clear. Those who lift themselves up, they're not upright. But the just shall live, will make it, shall live, and by his faith. We must continue faithful regardless of how dark the providence is around us. That's the ruling on us. We shall live, and we shall live by faith. We will not lift ourselves up. We will put ourselves down. We will remember, who does God seek? He dwells in the high place of the heaven of heavens, the eternal one. He says, and he looks upon those with a contrite and a broken spirit and dwells with them. So that's the solution here. Contrite, broken, humble men and women seeking their, you know, to honor God and walk his ways, they shall live by their faith. Their faith in God and their faithfulness to God, even in these horrendous circumstances, God will preserve them. They shall live. It's not will or may. They shall live by their faith. And that's what marks the just. In contrast with the preceding semi-verse, their heart is not lifted up in them. So when we look at maybe Queer Nation versus American Christianity, certainly Queer Nation's heart is lifted up in them, no question about it. I mean, they're out there proud as can be what they're doing and maintaining for gay rights and gay nation status, blah, blah, blah. There's just arrogance and pride on parade, sometimes literally on parade. You know, demand things be their way. No question about it, and it's going to be that way or else. I'm going to set fire to buildings, do whatever it takes, send policemen to the hospital, whatever it takes. Their heart is lifted up in them, but they're not upright. But the just shall live by their faith. See, that verse, which of course was the center point of the Reformation, is slightly taken out of context, because the issue is, how do we live when our nation is under judgment, when we've been made fishes of the sea for, you know, evil men to judge? When we're under correction like this, when we're under judgment of God, how shall we live? What shall we do? Here's the answer: the just shall live by his faith. So that's the context of this famous verse, which is quoted many times in the New Testament, Hebrews and Romans 2, for example, all telling us the importance. So I want us to at least see the original setting of this wonderful verse. It tells us that we're not lived by the works of the law, and he's just not because he's trying to gain righteousness by works of the flesh, but rather he's just because he leans on God's mercy and does not lift up his heart in himself. Because, of course, the person who says, I've done all of God's law, their heart is lifted up in himself. That's the Pharisaical attitude. I've done all that God requires. I am accepted by God, therefore. And rather, we should say, we're all sinners. Paul, I'm the chief of sinners. Or Joab to someone else saying, no, I'm the most brutish of all men. Of all men, I'm the most brutish. That's the right attitude. Because God can work with that kind of clay in our hearts. That is malleable, easy to work with clay that God can form and shape. And you will be strengthened as a consequence of going through the correction period, the period of judgment and correction. But we must live by our faith. We must not therefore conclude that it's time to join Queer Nation or these other groups or the Cubans simply because, hey, God seems to be not with us anymore. But if it seems that way, it's because who left first? Who left God first? Who decided not to honor God by walking in their ways and honoring and teaching all his commandments? Who slackened the law of God first? So we should joyfully receive correction. Of course, that's, we teach that for our children. We don't accept that as a nation of Christians, though. We tell our children, you smile after I spank you. And you. But boy, we better be ready when our nation gets hit with judgment to rejoice. Be singing in prison like Paul did. Let's see that happen a bit, too. I'm saying this for me as well as anyone else. I'm not, you know, saying, "You're all sinners, you too." You know, I'm not pointing the finger, because of course they say several other fingers are pointing back at me when I make these claims. So it has to go across the board for everyone, preacher and the preached to, congregation and the pulpit. Everyone needs to be considerate of the fact that we need to take correction joyfully. As we all notice, hey, God's not destroying us, He's correcting us. And He only chastises His sons and daughters. He wouldn't care if we were bastards, but He counts us His sons and daughters, as He did Israel here. He wouldn't have sent Babylon in except He cared for His nation and its decline. And He wanted to correct it, and that was the means. And boy, after they got back from Babylon, there was no more idolatry in Israel. It was that perfect, a cleaning out of all idolatries. No more having to go in there and get rid of high places for false gods and Baal worship. No more. It was cleaned out. So it was that effective. It was almost too effective. So much so that the Pharisees couldn't see Christ when He came. Part of that was in their hearts. It wasn't necessarily the blame for the purity of worship. Nothing wrong with purity of worship. But they made it something more than what God commanded. They went beyond the Scripture, and therefore were binding men's consciences where the Scripture did not. So it's important to see what we need to do. Because I think if we're not in a period of correction and judgment, it sure looks doggone close to it. And even if we're not, this can happen in our families. It can happen in a school. You never know what kind of strange things occur. State comes in against a school. State comes in against a family. Church comes in against a family. Family attacks a church. Anything can happen. So what's the situation? What do you do? Well, various possible scourges are occurring. The right thing for us to do is to stay faithful. Live by our faith. And be just by not having lifting ourselves up in our own hearts. Just keep our hands far away from our mouth so we don't kiss them. Because that's the big temptation, to be like the Chaldeans. Because of course the Jews did the same thing in essence. Common activity. Recall the man that God struck down in the book of Acts for proclaiming himself like a god. I think it was one of the Herods or some associate of them. And his worm didn't die, if I recall, in the passage of Acts. He arrogated to himself divine power. God does not long tolerate it. In case of Babylon, He tolerated it for quite some time. But God is a merciful God. You know, He's slow to wrath, slow to anger. That must tell us something. The queer nation is marching now. Must have been decades of tolerance on God's part before He sent these people up out of the woodwork against righteousness, encompassing us about by people like this. God is slow to anger, but He's rich in mercy. He's ready to forgive. He allowed 120 years during the building of the ark for the world to repent. 120 years! The continual testimony of this ark being built, this gigantic boat. They had time, plenty of time, to repent. So let's hope it doesn't take 120 years of queer nation marching around and getting power and getting seats in the Senate and Congress and finally the presidency before we finally wake up, right? Better wake up now while the signs are still relatively early. Because you know it says in Scripture, if they will but see God's hand raised against them, He'll heal them and restore them. And they got to start by praying. The prayer is ineffectual and abominable if we are not righteous. God goes to work against a nation when God's law is made void. Famous verse from Psalm 119, verse 126. That's exactly what Habakkuk 1:4 is talking about. He slacked, the law of God is slacked. What can we expect? Is American Christianity slacked God's law? You betcha. We defended it in theology books for the last 150 years. We slacked God's law and endorsed the slacking of God's law as a group. Of course, there are scattered exceptions who've maintained God's law is not to be slacked. You cannot do that to God's law. Who is man to take pieces of God's law and say, don't bother with that, don't bother with this, and this is not important. This is more important than that, so you can ignore the former when they're not really in collision. No, we are asking for the kind of judgment that Habakkuk describes here. We expected, but we should also remember to live justly and to live by our faith. And that will get us through. And we'll be ready for the restoration when it comes. Look how much better off Israel was after Babylon than before. And the rebuilding of the temple. Sure, it was a smaller temple. Sure, people wept because it wasn't as big as the big one that Solomon built. But it was a greater temple. You know why? As Haggai points out, because the Holy One of Israel walked into the second one. Jesus showed up there. It never happened in the first one, just the Shekinah glory. But God walked bodily in there and taught children and priests alike So even the smaller temple rebuilt, greater glory to the second house. We'll be in the same boat. American Christianity will be in a better boat once it's corrected. We're just going to be awful shocked and unhappy at the fact that it might be a group as militant as Queer Nation doing the correction of American Christianity. We're denouncing them, calling God to judge them and destroy them, and we might be shocked to find out God sent them against us, and we deserved it. Shocking thought. Possible? According to Habakkuk, this is pretty well God's pattern against a declining, unfaithful covenant people. That's us. That's us to a T. Sure, there's some righteous people here. Sure, there were some righteous people in Sodom. But, you know, as we prayed earlier, Capernaum, Jesus said, oh, Capernaum, you know, raised up all the way to heaven, should be brought down to hell. Here's the great America, lifted up, now the only superpower left. Is it going to be in the same boat as Capernaum, brought down to hell, with all the blessings that it's had? Pray for this nation. Live righteously. Speak the truth. These things will be the key elements in restoring our country, and so that we would be closer to the front of the nations, the roll call of the world on the last day, than at the rear. It's one of the greatest disappointments in all history. A nation that was given everything and squandered it all into wickedness. And therefore, the nation descended into death. A well-deserved death. Nations do die. They rise and fall. God lifts them up and pulls them down. This one's ripe for being pulled down if it doesn't turn fast or soon. And it might take 70 years of domination before we get the message, just like Israel. You know, we considered ourselves the new Israel when we were planted as a nation. Well, maybe the new Israel is going to repeat some of the lessons of the old Israel. Habakkuk is telling us as much. Don't be shocked if an evil people takes control, and takes control with impunity, and has their way over you, encompasses you about, and wrong judgment proceedeth. What do you expect when the foundations that the righteous should have established and built on and maintained were allowed to rot? And the rotting of those foundations were defended by Christian theologians for the last 150 years. They let them rot. We're going to rapture. Yeah. We're going to pay dearly for this rebellion against God. Any questions on our lesson?
Well, now, were you equating America with the new Israel?
I'm saying that the early sermons, if you look at the election artillery sermons, they equated America with a new Israel, but just not to say that they defended British Israelitism as a doctrine. They simply said God establishes in these isles a new Israel.
Now, what is there a word of balance here for Christian activists or involvement in activism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see Habakkuk is denouncing the Chaldeans. There's no question, but he also knows that God sent them. Now, he got that information from God direct, that God's sending them for correction and judgment. And the reason that he knows that they're in trouble is because he's been forced to behold his own nation sinning badly and slacking God's law. And he knows that the very same law says, you know, you don't obey my laws and enforce them, I will enforce them on you from the outside. So everything was totally according to God's pattern. They had no reason to expect anything else than the invasion from Chaldea. They deluded themselves.
Either or situation. In other words, you're not encouraging a retreat to pietism.
Never.
So that we as Christians need to live by faith. Justified by faith and walk by faith, but there's still that prophetic role of the church that we've talked about in denouncing evil and wickedness by God's judgment.
Ah, but you see, we never follow God's pattern. We want to denounce God's divine judgment on evil, but where does God start with the judgment?
The
house of God. And we don't want to start there. We want to start with them, with the outsiders. But it says, what does it say in Scripture? We don't have to worry about the outsiders. We're supposed to judge those in the house of God. This is what church courts are for. It says God's going to handle them.
Well, I guess a good illustration could be the swagger thing. You know, recently, I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah, again.
But another, you know, and there's a big part of the church, I guess, that follows him.
That's right. They don't. I wonder.
We don't properly judge that.
Should we not?
Affairs.
Oh. Jesus made it his point as he walked among the seven churches and the seven candles to give them all a message. And if we see a church failing and say nothing about it and maintain silence, it's equivalent to winking. So churches aren't talking to each other like they should be and reproving each other where they need to.
I'm saying is, this is what the church today is doing.
Right.
I mean, the man's got a huge TV ministry
right.
or whatever he's got going.
So he's got 488 more times to do this. He needs to be forgiven 70 times 7 times, so it seems to me he can become a pastor and keep up the subscription to Hustler for a good 100 years more at that rate, right? But you see, he's disqualified himself from office the first time around. He forced himself back into office and had nothing but contempt for the disciplinary actions of his Assembly of God group. I forget the actual synod or whatever that was involved. He wanted the money from preaching. He didn't want to be withheld from earning his monies for that long a period of probation.
But you're saying, if I hear you right, what you're saying is the church as a whole really has slackened God's law.
Yes.
And as a result, we are seeing what we see in the world today.
I say that if you look at the situation of Sodom, of how few people God was willing to spare the city over, we're simply getting down to very thin numbers as Christians that are truly faithful, and we better increase those numbers and send the trumpet, make it a clear trumpet. You know, we're thinking the wrong way. We're seeing queer nations saying, boy, is God going to get them? And we're not seeing it properly. We better look and see what we're doing that God would have sent them in our midst. They got it totally wrong. We got the whole picture totally reversed. Not that we shouldn't be denouncing their actions and what they are and what they represent, but their presence here is significant. It may well be an axe in God's hands. I mean, for every member of Queer Nation, God might have his grip around that leader, moving him whichever way he wills, because of Christian dereliction and sin. Why else would they be here? Not because the church is so righteous and doing a great gangbuster job. No way would God visit them upon us. And they're not there to become our, as I can tell, a tremendous missionary field for us. They seem to be quite militant. They're totally burned out. Full apostasy has occurred in them. So to have this institution on our hands in the 1990s is a significant sign of judgment against the church. It's corrective judgment. We better act on it. And we get corrected fast. Receive correction. That's the whole point. The church is unwilling to receive correction from God. Ready to receive a rapture from God and all sorts of blessings and Cadillacs, but not correction. And we wonder why there are queer nations right here. We're making a big mess down in West Hollywood and Santa Monica and the airport and wherever. They're in our backyard because we have not kept the faith. We have abandoned the faith once delivered to us and upon which the nation was built and which our forefathers made us culpable to keep. Marshall Foster is right. I didn't used to hold that strongly that there was an American covenant, but I'm now convinced absolutely that he is right. It is totally a biblical doctrine. That we have been committed to keep it. And our declension and our decline is going to be the cause of our downfall if we don't repent. Any other questions?
Thanks, Martin.